So let's start with having you identify yourselves, because this is radio, and of course, you know, if this was television, we'd know exactly who was in the room, but being that it's radio.
Jerry Casale, Devo.
Mark Mothersbaugh, Devo.
So I went back and looked at the evolution of the band, and I think that the reason that you formed is equally relevant today, and both, whether it's the Devo concept or the Jihad Jerry concept.
Okay, we started the band to make a lot of money and get laid.
We started the money...
there we go.
Yeah, we started the money.
Is that, you want to leave it at that, Mark?
And killed the band.
What started as more of a performance art thing really did affect things. So is it amazing to you that this many years later, what is it, 28, 29 years later, how much what you've done has really affected the culture?
I'd like to think it affected it. I think actually all that happened is we accurately predicted something we didn't really want to have happen. We wished we were wrong. But de-evolution is real and has exceeded our most, what would you call it, paranoid expectations.
And that's aptly put, yeah. We were concerned citizens that looked around and we could only describe what we saw as de-evolution, and unfortunately, it's the downward spiral has been faster than expected.
You know, scientists will always explain that things that happen, phenomena are exponential in their velocity. And I think as the minute we started sniffing it, it was already on the fast track. And obviously, we live in a world where the facts don't matter, because most people are another strain of humans that can't think logically anymore.
To think that Rolling Stone back then called you fascists, Rolling Stone of all people. I mean, it's kind of bizarre when you think about it, isn't it?
Well, you know, they described us as wearing uniforms, yet they were proponents of the most boring, bland uniform, which was blue jeans at the time.
So. And you know you are in the home of Ben Fong Torres in Rolling Stone as we're sitting here. This is where it all started in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's nothing to brag about.
Like any movement, whatever true validity or spirituality there was in the beginning of that movement, it was quickly co-opted into just something that could be icons and symbols like, you know, long hair and blue jeans and flowered shirts. I mean, it happens to everything all the time. And so people become their own worst enemy. And what Mark was saying about Rolling Stone is really true. They became the arbiters of taste and then decided almost from like left-wing style politically correctness to be as narrow and as intolerant as the right wing.
The last time, am I correct, that Devo really performed as a band was Lollapalooza in 1996. Was that designed to be a one-off? Because here you are doing some gigs in, you know, in L.A. and here in a few other places.
Well, there was no design. We were just asked and we did it. We don't believe in intelligent design.
We're middle-aged. I mean, you know, we never like to bowl. We don't really take drugs. We don't really handle drugs very well. And none of us golf, so...
So what the heck else is there to do in your spare time?
So this is it for us. So
we might as well play music.
Yeah, we go out and we're Devo still.
And we can lose about 12 pounds a piece.
Now, you're playing pretty big shows. These are big shows. These are not, and it's an interesting thing because a lot of bands that, quote, do a, you know, comeback without a new record out, these are big, big shows. So, you know, thanks to Rhino compilations and all that, it's all remained very much alive, which is just a factor of the timelessness of the music. But I guess my question would be, what about the new audiences who you're getting to turn on to the whole point that the band was started by?
Well, they got the extra bonuses that they can just download the music for free, basically. So they don't have to buy records. And we're not trying to sell any anyhow, so.
It's more that the music gets out there and the concept and the message gets out there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally kind of gratified that enough 18-year-olds in their freshman year have discovered Devo and decided for them it's hip because they missed it the first time around. Yet there's something that we did right in our music that remains timeless and doesn't sound dated because of the themes, the compositions, the combinations of sounds, the way parts fit together. They all are things that a lot of bands now are doing.
But speaking of now, I think the most interesting thing about all this, looking back over all these years that I've been playing your music, is I look at your website, and I looked at it today, and I have to say it's evolutionary because all of the communication that's going on there. So did you ever think back in 1977, 78, that you were going to be able to communicate with an audience and get all these messages out in this way? I mean, you've got a whole new, you know, And you know, we're talking about how time passes. You know, the big joke, of course, is how old is the internet, and look where we all are. You know, you're mentioning downloading, but look at all the things you're doing on your website.
You know, it's just one thing along the way. You know, we put subliminal messages in TV commercials. We used to, we hoped for something better than MTV before MTV came along. We imagined sound and vision television. We imagined a music television that was something better than it was. And so, you know.
But what was in the water? I mean, okay, so you came out in 78. I interviewed the Talking Heads when I was like 22 years old in 77. Had no idea who I was interviewing at the time. You know, I listened to it and I'm like, oh my goodness. So what do you think really was in the rock and roll water in those years? Because the 70s, people look at the 70s as, at least the early part of it, as a musical void. You know, they look at it as Bobby Sherman and they look at it as all these other things. But then towards the end, right on that cusp, you came along, David Byrne came along, a lot of pretty influential things that have not died at all to this day suddenly appeared.
You know, I think part of it is it was a reaction to disco and just to how it seemed like after all the shootings and the things that happened in at the beginning, end of the 60s and early 70s, how it's like America kind of went to sleep. Everybody was like, this is a little too real, you know, and they all kind of... There was no real music that had any message to it. It was like you had your white big concert music, you know, with we're stupid, we're misogynistic, we're conspicuous consumers, and we're proud of it. And then you had your disco, which was like a beautiful girl with no brain. And I think there were bands that just thought, you know, whatever happened to the Bob Dylans? You know, whatever happened to somebody that was talking about things that related to people's lives?
Well, thank goodness you eliminated that by nature of your band forming and others like it. You eliminated what was pretty much
remember when that stuff was going on. Okay, there were some precursors like Captain Beefheart and some interesting things in the early work
Bonzo
of Roxy.
Bonzo Dog Band.
Yeah, Bonzo Dog Band in the early work of Roxy Music when, you know, it was being experimental,
right?
And song structure was interesting, and the lyrics were really whacked. There was all this strain building up to something there was no name for. You got to remember, there was no name for such as performance art, for instance. Nobody had heard of deconstructivism to explain Devo's Satisfaction or David Byrne's Psycho Killer, because we were deconstructing music is what we were doing. We were going back to the roots of rock and roll and combining it with electronics and actually messing around with the structure.
But you were in Akron, they were in Rhode Island, so, you know, it's just interesting that it all kind of came together.
The monkey theory.
Yeah.
It happens everywhere, and it was happening everywhere.
And I mean, there, you know, to a certain point, everybody had the same information available. Even though we were in a cultural wasteland in the middle of the country, we're a factory town where everything had shut down, you know, we still had TVs, and we still could read
magazines.
You know, magazines, and see what was happening. And we knew there was a Haight-Ashbury, and you know, we knew there was a Manhattan, and we knew there was, you know, London, and things were happening at other places. They were just in these little pockets of energy, and so everybody had the same information.
So I want to go a few minutes at least on Jihad Jerry, because, you know, it showed up, and of course, the indie promoter was all over me. Said, "Okay, you're the one that's going to break this record. And if anybody's going to break this record in San Francisco, it's going to be you." But the character is hilarious. But there's a serious, you know, I went on the website for quite a while today and listened to all the diatribes and laughed at the animation, you know, and knew exactly from whence it was coming. But there's a serious political statement going on. So do you think this administration's attracted more of that than anyone else since, say, Nixon? That, you know, I just saw the U.S. versus John Lennon and what the Nixon administration, you know, supposedly did to make his life a little difficult,
well,
and all
know,
the conspiracy theory and all that lovely stuff.
Well, whatever the Nixon administration did, and we lived through that, you know, that was the era of where we were old enough to have a lot of political awareness. Whatever they did, and however bad we thought it was, the corruption, the right-wing revival of Christianity, the Vietnam War being a debacle, that was kindergarten compared to the world we live in today. When you look back at that, you almost like pine for the old days, because there was a lot more do-it-yourselfism, not just in music, but in the culture. People could be outraged by finding out the kinds of things that they find out today. When they find them out today, they go, oh, yeah, right, sure. Now, just shut up. We don't want to lose our jobs. But then there was truly a groundswell, a grassroots movement of people that were really pissed off and really concerned about the decimation of democracy. Now it's like, it's all like a McDonald's commercial, like, you know, hey, I'm loving it. So nobody gives a that democracy is being danced away by the Pied Piper. They're all following to the tune.
And how come G.I. Jerry, of all places, made his way from his country to Yonkers? Because I always thought the Yonkers Raceway kind of harbored radicals. So perhaps that's why he was there?
Well, yeah, a lot of people with turbans were walking around Yonkers.
The look of the character in the videos you did, it stands out because most music videos today are either bad performance with no concept or borrowed from the latest trend, be it shaky cam, and what you did is you just created this guy as what he would really feel like if he was,
yeah,
you know, in existence.
Sure, I was doing what we always did in Devo, which was creating an alternative world that you could step into, you know, and just skewed the real one a little bit by turning it on its ear a little bit. And Jihad's supposed to be a character that's humorous but also a lightning rod for hostility, and like Rodney Dangerfield, gets no respect and is totally misunderstood because obviously he's kind of a troublemaker because he hates all fundamentalisms, no matter who they're coming from, whatever the particular flavor is in clothing. It's fundamentalism itself that is the most dangerous weapon in the world today.
And he chose some really radical backup singers, too. I noticed, I went to the MySpace site, and I noticed one of them has an interesting career.
Oh, yeah.
so to speak.
Yeah.
But she can sing her heart out, but...
yeah, she's a dominatrix.
Yes, and I saw that.
Specializes in PVC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you figure that, you know, in this radical world of ours, he needs somebody like that to change the world.
Well, he, you know, he has sexual urges like any red-blooded American.
Is this a one-off, or do you think he's going to defend our world against other foes in the future?
Well, if Jihad Jerry's able to stick around, it will have to be because of some other force besides Cordless Records.
Mark, what possessed you to go into the, quote, commercial world and try to change it?
Sort of like a science experiment. It was, you know, just an interest to find ways to, you know, like, permeate the culture. I mean, when you're in a band, what happens is you end up getting pigeonholed, you know? It's like, you know, people, and for us, it's, in some ways, Whippet was like maybe one of the less fortunate things that happened to us in some ways, because, you know, our record company kind of ignored, you know, we made some money for them, you know, with the first couple records, but when we did the third one and had a hit record, then we were on their radar screen, and they showed up at our recording sessions, and it would be like, hey, do whatever you guys want to do, just do another Whippet.
Yeah, just do another hit.
Mm-hmm. Right. The thing about commercials that was attractive to me was just that you can, You have a much wider palette you can work on. It's more conceptual, in a big way and in a way that changes from day to day, as opposed to being in a band where you're a little bit of an iceberg whether you want to be or not. You know, what was exciting to us about Devo is we conceived Devo as being more like a clearinghouse for ideas and for concepts and for projects, and it wasn't even purely a musical endeavor at the beginning. We wanted to make films. We wanted to do theatrical. We thought of Devo as you know, something kind of a smarter version of what Blue Man Group does now. We originally conceived Devo not to be us going out on stage. We thought of us as the creators, and we'd send out maybe three or four different Devos out there to play the music. And we, you know, of course, then when you sign with a record company, then, you know, the reality of them wanting you to fit into the rock and roll world comes crashing down, and you find out that they don't really care about your ideas. They were just trying to sell some plastic.
whatever that world is supposed to be and whatever they perceive. And the proven, you know, we're talking about downloads, what it's proven is they really don't know what's going to sell, and they really don't have the A&R people don't really get what they're supposed to get in the long run.
Well, you know, record companies are disintegrating, and it's probably not the worst thing, you know. It's the whole concept of selling popular music or folk music or any kind of music is in the history of music, it's only existed for a short period of time in the last maybe 100 years since Edison invented wax cylinders, you know. So everything could go somewhere really great now, you know. Once you get
possibilities are endless now. It's a little more open.
Yes, if you can like remove record companies out of the whole mathematics of it all, you might end up with something surprising and better.
We fill the rest of the hour, and again, something that no one would dare do these days. We call it a musical sandwich. And what it is two of Devo's songs as the bread, and then as many fillings as you want in between.
Start it with a Devo song, end it with a Jihad song. How about that?
All right.
Okay, so we'll pick those two, and then we'll pick some stuff in between.
All right. So what's the Devo song?
I'd pick something off the first album. I'd say either Satisfaction or Giacomo.
All right, so we'll it's just gonna do a club sandwich.
It's going to be a
put
club,
Jihad in the middle.
It's going to probably be a club sandwich with six pieces of bread by the time we finish. Who cares?
Let's see. Then I'll let you choose. I mean, I love the time is now, and I love if the shoe fits, and we still have that monstrous, evil, menial, hateful man as our president. So we might as well play a song about him.
We need a Captain Beefheart song in there.
That's for sure. Spotlight Kid.
Spotlight Kid would be good. Yeah.
Or the Clear Spot. But Spotlight Kid's pretty good. Let's go back. Let's go back to the original, great recording of "I'm a Man" by Muddy Waters.
Lothar and the Hand People. Machines.
Love it.
That's good. Okay. We don't need that fascist groove thing. Heaven 17. How about the Hives? I hate to say I told you so.
How about something by the Rolling Stones? Damn. Well, see, they got a million good songs. Okay, play Last Time.
Great song. Killer song.
Couple more?
How about just, what's that song that the shiny toy guns have out right now that sounds like 1982?
Oh, I know. I don't know the name of the track, but I've played it.
It's so perfectly produced to sound just like 1982.
You know, there's a Beatles song where they ripped off the beginning of Uncontrollable Urge called I Want to Hold Your Hand.
You're kidding me. They did that to you?
Led Zeppelin.
How could they do that
Led
to you?
Led Zeppelin did it too. Led Zeppelin ripped us off too.
See, even your heroes, you can't trust your heroes.
No, you can't. No. So what do we do about this?
We'd have to ask Lenny Kravitz. He's been ripped off so many times.
You think so, poor Lenny Kravitz?
Poor Lenny.
Any closer you'd like to do on that happy note?
I'm not going to go his way.
No.
Lenny Kravitz's, that is. I'm not going to go his way.
You don't want to do that one, huh?
No,
Lenny Kravitz,
I don't.
In this
no.
Man,
No, we wouldn't.
I play him so heavily, as you can imagine.
Yeah, no.
He's in heavy rotation with me on a regular basis, Lenny Kravitz's.
If you're willing to play any of his songs backwards for the whole length of the song, you can put anyone on you want.
You can do that easily these days. You put it into Pro Tools, just reverse.
Let's don't do that to your listeners.
You can. Let's end with King Cotton's Stick to the Ground.